accession number 22077, reel 17.
You come into it, you turn sharp left in that. That's where our place was before New Scotland Yard was built. So it was called headquarters, Great Scotland Yard, military police. And I had quite a few men there actually at the time.
How big a place was that then?
Oh, we had first floor, my colonel's office, quite large, the major's office, quite large, the lieutenant's office, quite large. The RSM's office, I had a big office, and then the men's section offices, because they couldn't work all together. Sometimes you'd have two chaps on the same inquiry would be in an office, otherwise they'd do their work when they came back in their own offices. So it was quite a large, the whole of the first floor. Very, 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 very nice accommodation, by the way. And I must tell you this, my car... I said to the colonel, what am I going to do with my car? He said, oh, that's all right, Metcalf, don't worry. And when I got there, he gave me a pass. And it was Horse Guards Parade. And my car, I used to park my car on Horse Guards and just walk across, you see. This happened all the time. And 2 years after I came out, I went up to see the colonel on the, when I was doing an inquiry from Bristol when I was a security officer. And I phoned up, and the girl on the exchange said, is that you, Mr. Metcalf? She was as Scots as you made them. And I said, yes. She said, where the hell have you been? I said, I'm out the army. She said, oh, we do miss you, you know. And I went across and I put my car where I always did. And when I came back to fetch it, there was concierge there. And he said, I haven't seen you for a long time. I said, no, I've been out the army 2 years. He said, I said, the colonel told me to put it here. But that's, by the by. But that's, we had... We lived at Mill Hill, which is a very posh place. Barracks, of course, you don't say barracks, because when I said I was at Kensington Palace, yeah. I never said barracks either. And I went to a church there, and I became the choir master. The organist chap was a wonderful man, and I wish his name would come back to me, because his daughter became the president of the Methodist Conference. And when she came to Bristol, I went to see her, and we had a long time together, my Julie and I. His name's gone out of my head. The man she married was the principal of the Wesley College in Bristol. And I stayed with this little choir for quite a while. And when I came back, before I went to London, I had to go to Woking. That was our headquarters, military police at the time. And getting there, I went through Brookwood, and on the side of the wall, the church wall, they were going to do the Messiah, and they wanted singers. I got off the bus, took my suitcase with me, and went. Fortunately, the choir master happened to be there, and I was in uniform, and he said, who are you? And I told him, and I said, I'd like to sing in your Messiah if I get the chance. I said, I'll be stationed near you. You know, and he said, oh, where are you? And I told him, and he said, will you be able to make it? I said, well, it's up to you. He said, are you a solo singer? I said, yes, I know all the... He took me there and went to the piano, and he said, oh, yes, please come. So I knew Massam pretty well. So we went down one day when they put this show on. He lived at...
You'd have to tell me on the next reel.
Yeah.
Harold Morris Metcalf, end of reel 16. Harold Morris Metcalf, Reel 17. So you spent, what, 3 years? 3 years?
Yes.
About at?
Yes, nearly.
Great Scotland Yard.
Yes.
Were you due to retire at the end of that time?
Yes, I was, actually. I didn't want to, by the way, but I'll come to that later, probably. It won't be politic to say it just now for a reason. I did one inquiry. I was asked by the RSM to do it, by my colonel to go down, and he said, there's been a bit of a problem at the YMCA. He said, in fact, a girl's been murdered. It's been more than a bit of trouble.
Sorry, where was this?
In Scotland, from the yard where I was serving, yes, in
London.
The YMCA in London. And I've got the man's name here with whom I worked, actually. To cut a long story short, because it is quite a long story, I'd heard about this, and I went with this detective on this job because it was believed to be a soldier. And we did the inquiries, couldn't get anywhere. The girl said, yes, her boyfriend had been with her, but all the time, you know, never went out, she went back with him and so on. One of the girls who was staying at the Y. And so the case sort of was in abeyance. And then the colonel sent me down to Cumbermere Barracks at Windsor on another inquiry, a larceny of a large amount of blankets. Quite a job it was. When I got there first, I was in civilian clothes. I reported to the adjutant, and he said, I'll get the officer up, and he'll talk with you. And this bloke came up to me and said, well, the position is this, Mr. Metcalf, blah, blah, blah. He told me all about it. And while we were talking there, a man came up to him, and he said, the officer said to him, excuse me, you don't smoke, do you, Sergeant Major? I did, but I didn't have he wanted a lighter. And he said to this chap, do you have any matches? And the chap said, no, sir, well, I have a lighter, you know, all rigid guards depot. And he produced this lighter. And I thought, that's funny. Can I see that? And then I had a look at it. I said, that's interesting. Where'd you get that from? And he said, the officer said, no, that's not it. The officer had the thing. The officer had the lighter. And I said to him, can I see that, sir? It's coming back to me now. And I looked at it, and it was the exact account of what I'd heard from the girl in the YMCA, that a lighter was missing from the YMCA.
All right?
I thought, that's funny. I said to the officer, from where did you get this? And he didn't want to tell me.
This was the officer's lighter, wasn't it?
Yes.
Right.
All right. Uh-huh. And he said, I'm sorry, sir, I want to know from where you got this. And he said, well, I don't want the colonel to know. I bought it from one of my men. Of course, that was in for dig in those days. You didn't do that, especially in the ruddy guards. And I said, who was it? And he told me. I immediately got on the phone to the CID Black, and he came down within an hour to Windsor and interviewed this bloke. And his story was all to cop to what he'd said before, anyway. And he had taken this from the room where this woman was murdered, if you please. That was the point about it all. I mean, we'd all led up to this before, and it was one of those things that worked out. I was taken off the case, of course, because it was a civilian job. But I kept in touch with the police officer. I've forgotten his name now, but we met quite a few times after this, in our social life, you know. But that was one job I was on there. And then the colonel said to me one day, I want you to go. I want you to go down to see the colonel of the guards with regard to some silverware that's gone missing. I went down there. Burscade Walk. I went to the barracks at Burscade Walk, saw the colonel, and he said, the officer concerned is on duty at Buck House, that's as he called it, and could you go down and see him? He's Lieutenant so-and-so. Now, I went, I hadn't been to Buckingham Palace at all before, not in my job. And, of course, I went up to the gate, and the policeman said to me, what do you want? And I said, well, I want to come in. He said, you know, sort of business. And I showed him my warrant card. He said, what's the matter? And I said, well, I have to see the guard officer. He said, oh, not here, son. Go around the back, and there's an entrance around the side there. And they'll let you in as long as you show your warrant card. I went round to the side, and the bloody door was open, yes? So I walked in, didn't I? No one said anything to me. I went past the guard room, which was on the left-hand side, and they were all in there playing cards. And I walked past, I walked right through, onto the lawn, had a good look round. I thought, how wonderful this all is. And coming back, there was a young second lieutenant. And he said, good morning. I said, good morning, sir. And he said, who are you? And I said, I'm RSM Metcalf for the Special Investigation Branch. You should have seen his face. I'm not joking. And I said, I'll have to inform my colonel about this when I get back. I said, I've been walking about here for the last 10 minutes. Nobody bothered to ask me who I was. And nobody did. I'm not joking. It happened at the War Office again sometime later, but with my colonel. We had to have passes and we had to give them in. We didn't do. We went down the back stairs. I still got them in one of my diaries. But this business was quite... He told me all about what had happened. And we didn't come to any conclusion how this silver had got out, by the way. He was the officer in charge at the particular time. I don't know what happened, because in my regiment, that was somebody else's job, not an officer. Anyway, we didn't get much fun. But that's not the point. I went back to my colonel and explained the case to him, and he said to me three times, the colonel and I were going to Bird's Cage Walk. We come back from somewhere, and we were walking across Green Park. And there were some bushes there. And we saw two pairs of feet. One was this way and one was that way. Male feet, yes? And my colonel looked at me and said, I don't believe it, Metcalf. And I said, go and see. So I went there and there was a man there with another man. But one was an officer man, yes, and one was a soldier man. They were both in civvies. Oh, it was, I'm sorry, it's fun when I think back to it, but it was bloody serious at the time. And the colonel did the job himself.
Yeah. So what happened to him?
He got chucked out. The officer got, he was a lieutenant in the guards. Mm-hmm. And I heard later that this sort of thing happened quite frequently in the guards, by the way. But it was nothing to do with me, but I heard. Mm-hmm. And the chap, I think he got 5 years, the other fella. But I wasn't called. The colonel took the case, you see, because he was an officer.
That's one of the things, see, that I'll ask you now, because it's almost about
yeah.
I mean, homosexuality was obviously existed back then, although it was hardly mentioned, I suppose, not in polite society.
I have a feeling that there was more buggery in the army than anyone ever knew. And I can quite understand. Can I put it this way to you? And I'm talking all out of turn, really. There were times, had I not been a Christian, and I was very strict salvationist, I could have understood what it was all about. And I think, as a boy soldier, I could have gone with a man, because they gave you money. You know what I mean? It never appealed to me, but there was an awful lot of it. And it was the most serious of crimes in the army.
But blind eyes must have been turned a lot as well, mustn't they? Do you think or not?
Well, I know there must have been. Mm. Because, I mean, in Singapore, I knew that one officer, when I went in there and saw him with the sergeant major, they were at it when I went in, you know. And I was frightened. I was frightened. And I didn't know what to do. I couldn't tell anybody. They wouldn't bloody believe me, would they? As I told you before, there were two of our boys were queers. They weren't really queers, but they were introduced to it, and they became queers as a result of it, of course. And, I mean, there were men in the regiment we all knew did it. Mm. And in every regiment, it was the same.
Yeah. And when you were in the military police, was that something that you would arrest people for?
Never had one case of buggery in my life. Never. Now, that's strange that you should say that.
Would the regiments have dealt with that within their own...
Well,
they've gone to court martial, or what?
The point about it is, if I might say, it never came to anything. How can I put this? That the regiment would have been in dirt, if you understand me. If that sort of thing had come out and they'd gone to court martial, and it would have been serious, of course, which it was.
Under the carpet.
Nearly always. So I never knew of a case of buggery while I was in the forces, ever time. We knew all about it, you know, and I knew who used to do it as well, but that's not the point, is it? You know, blind eyes were turned.
It was illegal, wasn't it, in Civvy Street? I mean, to
exactly.
C8 or something.
That's right, indeed it was. Yes, oh yes.
A serious offence.
It was indeed. So.
Which is difficult to believe. Well. In 2001, but.
Yes, I. But let me be fair about this. I could understand it with troops abroad. You couldn't have a woman. Soldiers were dirt, literally. So unless you knew a girl, you know, an Anglo-Indian girl or one of the married quarters' daughters or something, you didn't have any much fun getting a woman. It didn't worry me till I was 18 anyway, you know, it never entered my head. And I don't think I ever had much to do with girls. I was a boxer and I was an athlete and it didn't appeal to me at that time. I used to have wet dreams quite often, of course, but that's not the point, is it? And my Lance Corporal, Mabel Long, he was a queer. He never interfered with the boys or anything. He was a wonderful chap. But I knew he had a friend in the regiment, and that was it. But it was rife. There isn't any doubt about that, all over the regiments. As a result of not being able to have a woman, of course, that's the point, I think. But that's that time in Green Park, it really was comical. It was comical. My colonel could hardly believe it.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed my time in London because I was able to visit places that I would obviously not have been able to. And we had friends came over from Germany and we took them to see Brian Ricks. And I remember one night we took one of the girls down and my Morris 8, I hadn't turned the bloody lights off. And when I got out, it was as dead as a doornail. And I had to get the taxi to get us home. But
so when you came to leave the army, I mean, this was at the... How did you know... You've done more than 21 years by now.
Yes, I've done nearly 30 and a half. I had a 6 months extension to get my boy through his education.
Right.
He was schooling in London. Julie was there. She wasn't teaching at that school. She was teaching at Dulles. But both my children were... My girl came to Bristol to the grammar school here. And my son also went when he came back eventually. But he was...
So you knew you got the six-month extension?
Yes, for his education, so he could finish it. And I came...
So the date you left the army?
Before that... Three times, I did Queen's Birthday Parade.
Oh, right, yeah.
It's interesting for this fact. 57, 58 and 59, I did Queen's Birthday Parade. Now, my colonel and my major, myself, were loaded with a 38 revolver. We all had our revolvers. And loaded. There wasn't much of that sort of thing in those days, not like there is now. There was no much. But we were security. And we used to stand on top of the, you know where the horse guards is? Mm-hmm. There's an entrance arch. Mm-hmm. Above there, there's a flat roof.
Yeah.
And we used to be up there. Couldn't be seen unless somebody wanted to see us properly. And the first year I went, my colonel, we were going up the stairs as the Queen Mother came up. And she knew my colonel and spoke to him by name. And he said, "Good morning, ma'am." And he said, "This is my major, Major so-and-so, and this is my RSM, Metcalf." And she wished us, didn't shake hands, but wished us. And the following year and the following year, she wished me good morning when I went out of Pastor Bolton. But the second year, the Queen used to be on her horse. She always wore a tricorn hat. Yes? and it poured and it poured and it poured. And I can see her now. We're standing above and she keeps tipping her hat back to let the rain come out. It's all down her back. And just when the parade was over, when she gave permission for the parade to fall out, the sun came out. And it was quite warm at that time of the year, you know what I mean? I mean, it was only last week, wasn't it, the week before? And literally, as the troops were walking off, the steam was coming off their uniforms. They were soaking wet. I don't know, their bearskins must have been an awful state. But I've always remembered that particular year. So that was that. And
so you left on what date, then?
I retired from the army on discharged the 2nd of July 1960.
Right. And what your start date? I don't know that I've got that. Oh, yes, I have 6th of the 1st, 1930.
30, yeah. So I did 30 and a half years.
Mm. What were your feelings on leaving?
I didn't want to go.
Right.
My colonel actually went with me to the war house and tried to get an extension for me. But I was 45, and if I'd taken the commission, I'd have been all right. I should have been a major by then, apparently, but that's another story, isn't it? And in many ways, I'm glad I didn't take it. On the other hand, it could have been quite different for us after that. After my 6 months extension, The colonel went with me to the war house to try and get me still to remain in the forces. And they offered me a job outside of the police.
Oh, yes.
And
yeah.
I didn't want that.
Oh, right. What did they offer you?
I've forgotten what it was now.
Oh, right. But
I did have it here somewhere.
Yeah.
I did have it here. They offered me a job in another outfit, another unit. You know what I mean? You getting warm?
Yes. It wasn't something that you wanted to do.
No. Wait a minute.
So, what did you think you would do when?
Well, what I wanted to do actually was to be a probation officer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Before I came out the forces, incidentally, I was asked if I would like to do a course of any description, and I said yes, I'd like to do a house course. Building songs, you know, and I was awarded one at a place called Aldershot, and I went down there. There were two brigadiers, four generals, two captains, a major, two RSMs, two sergeant majors, three sergeants, four privates. By the end of the course, we were all calling everybody Tom, Dick and Ruddy Harry. It was wonderful, it really was.
And what was the course on?
It was on all home, what do you call it? What do you call that? month by month, bricklaying, plastering, practical householding.
Right, yes.
I learned to cut glass, I learned to do metal work, and we used to build.
Because, of course, you'd always been in army quarters.
Yeah. It was absolutely wonderful, the best course I ever did. Because when I came here to my house, I did everything in this house with my daughter. I made all the furniture in London, all that.
Really?
And all my other cupboards and all those and that over there.
So and even though it wasn't career training, it was a very sensible
that's right.
course to give long-term sources.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it really was the best course I ever did. And it was, I'm not joking, the very first day or so, it was all very frigid and rotten. And eventually the ice was broken by the blokes who were doing the work. Incidentally, the man in charge was the officer who'd been in charge of education in Hong Kong. So I knew him through my wife, and he was quite chuffed. And when I had to write a report when I left, I couldn't say enough about it because it taught me enough to do my job. But whilst I wanted to be on probation, I wanted to go on a probation job.
Yeah.
But before then, I had a friend from my regiment who was in London at the time, an officer, Captain Pope. He worked for a big dye works in Bristol here. And I wrote to him and he said, I spoke to Mr. Brooks, it was the Brooks Dye Cleaners, and he said, at the moment there's no vacancies, Mick. I was quite friendly with him, and we used to play hockey and rugby, and he'd had a bad accident and had a club foot by now. And Dougie Pope, he was a lovely man, and he said, what would you like to do? And I said, well, I would like to be a probation officer. And he wrote letters to the probation company here in Bristol. Mm. And they said, yes, I could be a probation officer, but not in Bristol. I'd have to travel all around the country. Well, I didn't want a job like that. I'd had enough traveling, if you know what I mean. And I wanted to settle down here. Some months later, I was in court on an inquiry when I was a security officer. And I met the chief probation officer, a very nice man, and we were chatting. He said, why didn't you put in probation work then when you came up the forces? I said, I did. And they told there were no vacancies in Bristol. He played hell. Honestly, he tried to get me out of my job where I was. I would very much, I didn't want to then. Yeah. I was a chief security officer.
Right. And that's what you did.
That's what I did. I came here just before I left my army service. They asked me if I would come to Bristol to have an interview, and I spoke to the colonel, and I came down here, and I went to this place, Metal Agencies Company in Winterstoke Road, which was a family affair, quite a family affair. Their father had just died, and the two sons had taken the job over.
Right.
And I had an interview there. They asked me, they said, would you like to come? Mm-hmm. And I left the army on the Saturday, and I started work there on the Monday.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Just a few questions. I'm looking through my list, and I think we've talked such a lot. I think,
yes, indeed.
We've probably answered most of them along the way. What about the actual discharge procedure? Where were you? Where did you actually have to sign out? You
know, nothing.
You didn't.
They just gave me a red book, my colonel,
right,
and gave me a set of lovely glasses and a briefcase as a present. And we had a party and. I cried my eyes out, of course, but I didn't want to go. I didn't.
No.
Nor did my wife. Yeah. She was quite happy then. Yeah. However.
Yeah. I mean, perhaps if we can think back to sort of VE Day time, and if I ask you then, because obviously you had such a long career in the
yes,
army after that,
quite.
Date, which, you know.
Yes, indeed.
Was into your mature years.
Yes.
But say then, you know, sort of round about 1945, I mean, what do you think you'd actually learned from being in conflict? I mean, you'd always been in the army from the age of 15,
yeah.
But what did you learn from wartime experience about yourself and perhaps about humankind? It's a difficult question.
It is a difficult question.
Did the war alter your perspectives?
If I hadn't been a Christian, yes, it would have done. I must tell you this. I didn't say this in the. When we came out of Let Padan, we'd had a bad time, and lost quite a few men. And some of the chaps came up to me and they said, Mick, would it be possible for you to give us communion? And I said, no, it's not allowed. That thing's. But they kept on to me, and I spoke to my colonel. At the time. Was Colonel Baggett. And he said, I see nothing wrong with that, Metcalf. It's all believers, that's all. If they want it, do it. I mean, they all knew I was a Salvationist anyway. And I still was at that time. I didn't know anything about communion, really, because we didn't take communion in the Salvation Army.
Yeah.
I did. And it was very moving to me, because I didn't really know what to do. I didn't know. They were priming me. There were eight of the chaps. Four of them were killed the next day. But the point I'm making is, the padre came up later on, and he said, is Sergeant Metcalf anywhere about? And I said, I'm in here, sir. And he said, can I come in? And I said, yes, sir. He said, are you any relation to me? My name's Metcalf too. But he had an E on the end of his name. We chatted for a long while, and I told him. And he said, I see nothing wrong with that at all. And that was one part of my life. We came to a place near Shwedong, and war is brutal anyway, there isn't any doubt about that. But we had lost quite a lot of men by the time we got there, and men were falling down with bullet holes in their heads. And they found that there was a sniper in a tree, tied up. I mean, the Japs couldn't care bugger about getting killed, you know. But the point was, the Blitz were going to shoot him, and the tank commander said, no, leave the bastard to me. And he went down there, and he set fire to the tree. He set fire to the tree with his gun, with his flame gun. And we watched him and cheered when the blood was bloody burning to death. You can't believe you could do it, but that was how it was. It was bitter, and we were... That night I cried my eyes out, going to bed, thinking that I... To think that I could be such a wicked man, but it wasn't wicked at the time, I'm sorry. No, that's how we
survival,
felt. It didn't make
survival.
Any difference.
Yeah, survival. Yeah. You had to cope with it.
That's right, it's quite true. But I really felt very much ashamed of myself later on. But I hated the Japanese, and I did, I told you.
Yeah. Do you think back to the war, does it haunt you at all now?
Yes. Yes, it did.
Yeah. Is it still?
No. When I got to my wife after when I was wounded and went to Mamie, up to Murray, she was upset the first night. I was shouting and screaming because it was all coming back to me. And I wasn't the only one, by the way. I heard a lot about it afterwards from some of the other chaps say it must have, well, it was awful. It was awful. There isn't any doubt about it. And I'm glad I didn't have to suffer the same bloody thing when I went to Korea, fortunately. I was glad, because my family were worried, of course, and well, so was I. But we had a friend, my schoolgirlfriend, Flo, her daughter and Flo, we meet once a month, and we went down into town at Debenhams. They came in, and I met them there, and we were talking about it, and she was talking about this, and she said, do you remember my little lad? He was a lovely little boy. He's a lovely man, too. But he said, my Uncle Mick's going to Korea, and so he'll make the war finish. Don't you worry. I'd only been there a few days when the ruddy war finished. And he went round and said, I told you so. But no, I'm sorry to say, I hadn't told you this. We had the American volunteer group while we were in Rangoon. They flew... We only had Bristol Bulldogs, which were very tardy. And fortunately, they didn't have the Zero fighter at that time, the Japanese. Otherwise, we'd have lost a lot more. We lost quite a few. And I was always doing funerals at that particular time. But they shot down a Japanese man, and he came down. Normally, they didn't bother. They just used to, you know, they didn't care whether they died or not. They didn't care, you know. And this bloke was in our guard room, and I was on guard duty one day, and he was the nicest little bugger you could wish to meet, you know what I mean? All the servile, and he'd been shooting our blokes down the day before, you know, sort of business. And you can't collate it, you know what I mean? No. No, I never thought... Let me put it this way. I joined the army to be a bandsman, a musician. I wanted to be a bandmaster, of course. But I never thought I was going to be in a war, and not such a war as I was in anyway.
You got more than you bargained for, didn't
no,
you?
No, I did. I got more than I bargained for, yeah.
Well, it's been absolutely fascinating.
Bless you.
Yeah, thank you very much for talking to us.
Not at all.
That's Harold Morris Metcalf, end of reel